Once again, welcome to everybody who's visiting. Lovely to have you here with us. I know there are various people visiting, family and friends. I hope you've been enjoying the worship, and that even me speaking is not going to ruin the overall effect of the morning. Now, I'm going to speak to us about the resurrection of Jesus, because this is the season we're in. And I wasn't able to be here last Sunday, so I feel left out. And I'll read you this well-known resurrection account from Luke's Gospel. One of the resurrection appearances of Jesus from Luke 24. That same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. He asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem and do not know the things that have happened there in these days?" "What things?" he asked. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it's the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning and didn't find his body. They came and told us they'd seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but him they did not see. He said to them, 'How foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?' And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus acted as if he was going to go further, but they urged him strongly, 'Stay with us, for it's nearly evening. The day is almost over.' So he went in to stay with them. When he was at table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, 'Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?' They got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. There they found the 11 and those with them assembled together and saying, 'It's true, the Lord has risen, has appeared to Simon.' Then the two told what had happened on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when he broke the bread." And so on. I don't know about you, but I have attracted a disappointingly small number of nicknames in my life. How many nicknames do you have? I've had very few. But one was John Resurrection Peters. And I'm very proud of that. That reflects the time when I first became a Christian. And really, that had a lot to do with considering the evidence for the resurrection in history from a lawyer's point of view, which is what I was when I became a Christian. And I was very aggressive and enthusiastic about my passion for the resurrection of Jesus and taught to anyone and everyone, so much so that I became known as John Resurrection Peters. There you are. So, this morning is about the resurrection. So Luke, who wrote this, Gospel of Luke, also wrote the book of Acts, a history of the early church, kind of a part one and part two. And one of the things that people will say about those who wrote the New Testament is that they were obviously expecting Jesus to come back by tea time shortly after, you know, Jesus was resurrected, and it was a bit of a shock and disappointment to them. He didn't pop straight back. Well, you could say, if Luke went to such extraordinary lengths, researching, consulting with eyewitnesses, as he says at the beginning of the Gospel, to record something this detailed and this long, write it all down, presumably he wasn't actually expecting Jesus to pop straight back. A detailed record of the progress of the early church and the life of teaching of Jesus. It's not like Jesus set this for him as like homework. Okay, Luke, when I come back, I want to check this to see if you've got it right. I don't think that was really going on. In fact, as far as Luke was concerned, the Gospels only present what Jesus began to do and to teach, whilst the book of Acts picks up what he continued to do and teach through his church. And therefore, Luke, in particular, gives great significance to the time between the resurrection of Jesus and the return of Jesus. He gives great significance to that time. And theologians talk about salvation history as a way of talking about how Luke dignifies our time right now. The time in which we, after the resurrection and having experienced the power of the Spirit, have the opportunity to engage with Jesus in what he was doing, his saving activity. So the idea is we as Christians are embraced in what Jesus is doing. It's the progress of salvation history towards the completion of God's purposes at the return of the Son. And Luke uniquely records a particular parable not found in any of the other Gospels in chapter 19. It's called the parable of the pounds, and it goes like this. A nobleman leaves for a far country, and he gives a coin to each of his servants. He tells them to trade with it. Two make substantial profits and are rewarded on his return, and the third hides his coin in a handkerchief and is condemned because he took no chances with the coin. And the message to all disciples living in the now of salvation history is this. You've been entrusted with any amount of kingdom treasure. Different ones of us with different amounts of kingdom treasure, resources. And the idea is that we would make a really fruitful investment of those treasures right now, while the time is ripe, while the fields are white and ready for harvest, as Jesus would say. While the Holy Spirit is on the move. And under no circumstances should we be found guilty of doing nothing with what we've got. Now, I am currently in a bit of a quandary, as in at this moment, because this morning when I read the passages that I read when I pray, it's a kind of a book which has different verses on the same subject gathered together from the Bible. And this morning's verses included this parable. Which I find a spooky coincidence, which makes me feel that that God is wanting to encourage some of us precisely to make sure that we are making a full use of what we've got. And I can't quite decide whether to just free flow about that or do what I prepared. All right. So the point is that we all have an extraordinary gifting. My experience of people in church is that some of them really know that. Occasionally, you find people who know that too well. In other words, they are quite arrogant. It's something that often belongs to the younger. They have too high a view of themselves. And then there are more people who have too low a view of themselves. In other words, they can't really believe that they have gifts at all. And even though everybody might tell them, and even though it's flipping obvious, it's a real struggle to actually put themselves forward, even in an area where they know they could do a good job, etc., etc. Now, let me just say that of the two problems, the first one is much better. The first one is much better because God can always deal with somebody that's a bit chippy and a bit cocky. He can always deal with that because the fact is, at least they're doing something. They're actually doing something, and as they go along, if they keep seeking the Lord, at least he will be able to refine them and sort them out. That was definitely me. And do you know where it came from, that sense of confidence and conviction that I was an important person? It came from my parents. My parents unequivocally loved me. My father was an interesting man in lots of ways, but he definitely communicated to me on a regular basis that he loved me. My father tends to exaggerate things. And so if I play tennis, which I did, if he was telling stories about me playing tennis, I would be an amazing tennis player. If I play football, which I did, I would be an amazing footballer. Of course, I was. No, the thing is, I wasn't. But in my father's eyes, I really was. And so when I became a Christian, it never occurred to me for one second that God would not want to use me in all things. Never even crossed my tiny mind. And the thing is, that led me to have issues of, you know, coming over as being really quite arrogant. After an initial phase of having literally nothing to say, I remember going to Christian things and simply sitting there and absorbing of what people were saying like a sponge, because I had no opinions. I had nothing to say at all. I just absorbed it. I knew nothing. It wasn't a conscious decision. I had nothing to say, and I just absorbed it. And then I remember beginning to speak. And beginning to speak meant beginning to speak to people who didn't believe in Jesus and gaining the nickname John Resurrection Peters. And the thing is, though, I was very confident in what God had shown me and what I knew, and also it naturally had an element of arrogance about me as well. But God has been able to work on me in that. And there's nothing like failure to help you realize that actually you're not all you think you are, and to find that God's grace is there even in failure as well. And you realize over time it's really not you, it's God, and anything good in you is from God. You work it out, yeah? And that's okay. But at least I've done things. At least I have tried to do something with what I've got. So I've done it badly, I've done it well, I've done it intermittently, I've done it, you know, aggressively, I've done it insensitively, I've done it rudely, I've done it graciously, kindly, I've done it. At least I've done it. I have done something with what I've got. And I know that God has changed me along the way. That is a better prognosis than, oh, I don't know. I don't know. I'm a bit of a worm, actually. I'm unworthy. Oh, woe is me. I am a slug. I am a slug in the house of God. See these other people, these giants of spirituality? I'm not like them. I am a worm. I'm a slug. I'm a sinner. I'm an awful person. I don't deserve to be used by God. God should find somebody else. That kind of thing. Now, the problem with that mentality, which can look like humility, actually, it's not. It can look like humility. Humility is this. It's knowing what is proper to you and what is proper to God. That's what humility is. Self-flagellation is not the same thing as humility. Beating yourself repeatedly because of various failures and problems is not humility. It's just not coping spiritually with the reality that we are all, without exception, broken and failed individuals. There isn't one of us here that hasn't got gaping problems of one kind or another. Not one person here. Not one person in any church anywhere. That is why we are here. We are here because of this problem. That's what unites us. Nothing else does. Apart from Jesus, of course. And so basically, what God wants from us in the light of the resurrection is that we should do something with what we've got. Just do something. Now, in my view, that should be something in the church and something in the world. People obsess about the question, what is their gift? Nobody has a gift. People are dribbling gift monsters. Every single one of us here is a dribbling gift maniac. You have an incredible range of gifts of every single kind that you could possibly care to mention. If you don't know what they are, then you really do have to spend time with people that know you, and they could tell you. They could help you to see it. They could remind you. So there will be some of us who wrestle with this lack of conviction about ourselves or God's willingness to use us, because conversely, they have experience of parenting, which is so negative, where nobody's affirmed them, nobody's encouraged them, nobody's been a strength to them, nobody's been had their back, nobody's supported them. And for this reason, there is a question always about who they are and what they can do. So confidence comes, I think, from having grown up with a proper understanding of what it means to parent a child, and lack of confidence often results from a lack of understanding on a parent's part about how to affirm their children. So it's a pretty critical issue, this. And some of us have been playing the Christian game for a long time. We know this. It's like some of our pains, it's an ongoing process that we're wrestling with. But I'm here to encourage you to do something with what you've got. Now, obviously, what you don't, these are some of the things you don't want to do. One of the things is you don't want to be somebody else. So there's literally no point in identifying somebody else that you think is amazing and trying to be them and comparing yourself with them and writing yourself off. I had a friend who was immensely talented, very intelligent, very charismatic person, really humorous guy, really attractive guy, really well-qualified guy. His problem was that his brother was so talented that he was being touted as somebody that could run his country. And so by comparison with that guy, this person always felt that he was nothing, and it stopped him from ever doing the things that he could really do, or taking any pleasure even in doing the things that he did. Now, to me, that's very sad. So, number one, don't try and be somebody else. Number two, don't try and do something you really can't do. So if it doesn't work, and it doesn't work, and it doesn't work, and people are actually trying to tell you, you know what, it doesn't work, it's not working, just leave it, do something else. We don't have a perfect sense of who we are and what we can do. Sometimes we have to try it, suck it and see. If it doesn't really work, just leave it. There's somebody here today I know who felt that they ought, for various reasons, to be fulfilling a particular role. They did it a few times, absolutely hated it, and with great courage said to me and to other people, you know what, I just don't want to do that. I admire that. I admire it. It's not like they've given up. It's like they just don't think they want to do it. Okay, don't do it. Do something else. Eric Liddell, the, you know, Chariots of Fire guy, when I run, I feel his pleasure. When I run, I feel his pleasure. So what you want to know is, what do you really enjoy doing? What do you sense flows most readily? Do that. Do it. Little things and big things, it all counts. Are you good at cooking? That counts. Are you good at singing? That counts. Are you good at needlework? That counts. Are you good at, I don't know, doing other people's hair? That counts. It doesn't matter what it is. If you're good at it, just do it. Give it to God and ask him to use it. God is like that. He likes to use simple, foolish, strange things and multiply the effect of it. What he doesn't like is doing nothing with what you've got. He doesn't like that. It bores him. Don't bore God. Anyway, back to the resurrection. So Luke records three strands of evidence for why all disciples should be certain that there was a resurrection. The first is that basically it was foretold in the Old Testament. So basically, Luke says through this story, okay, guys, we know that it was a nightmare. Jesus was crucified. Then he came back to life. It shouldn't have been a shocker for the disciples. Obviously, it was. It shouldn't have been. He did tell them about it beforehand. But more importantly, this is something that's always been part of the tradition, something that's always been there in the history, the suffering servant of Isaiah 53. If you read Isaiah 53, you could ask yourself, who else does this describe other than Jesus? It's interesting that when discoveries were made of various ancient texts at Qumran in the 1950s, they found a complete text of the book of Isaiah. And basically, that filled in a 1,000-year gap between our previous earliest extracts of the book of Isaiah. So we've got an unbroken book of Isaiah, knowing that we go right back into ancient history. And you know, there were 10 differences between this and the text that they found, the one in here and the one they found, and there were spelling differences. What that shows is people very carefully preserved their scriptures. And the book of Isaiah contains Isaiah 53, the suffering servant, one that would come, who would suffer, who would be despised and rejected, and who would nevertheless save his people. It perfectly describes the saving career of Jesus and his resurrection. So point number one is that to these disciples on the road to Emmaus is you are slow of heart and foolish to believe, because actually it's always been part of your tradition that this is what the servant would do. He would die, he would give his life, he would come back to life. It's all there in your scriptures. Point number two is that Jesus was radically transformed in his appearance. So there's this strange motif in the resurrection stories where people don't recognize Jesus, and then they do, often when he performs a characteristic action like the breaking of bread, distributing of wine. So, for example, when Mary first sees Jesus, she thinks he's a gardener. So there's obviously something different about the appearance of Jesus. On the one hand, he's the person they love and the person they knew. On the other hand, he's obviously been changed. So something's happened to his physical body post-resurrection. He now has a new body and not so much, you know, departed this life as entered into a glorious new dimension of life. So there's something in the appearances which are totally real. So after this account, Jesus appears to the disciples. They're terrified, they're filled with joy, they don't know what to do with themselves. And he says, got any fish? And he eats a bit of fish just to show them it's really him. Presumably he liked fish before, I don't know. But basically Jesus still does physical things, but clearly his body is somewhat changed. So Luke presents that. I do like the resurrection appearances in that some of the resurrection stuff you just never put in if you were trying to con people. For example, in Matthew you have that fantastic line, the disciples are worshipping Jesus, but some of them doubted. You would never put that in, ever, if you were trying to con people. Oh, by the way, you know what? Some people didn't believe it, even while it was happening. You don't even put that in if you've got nothing to hide, because it really happened. Or you would never have Jesus appearing to women. Why? Because women were not credible witnesses at law. So it doesn't really matter what we think about women. In those days, if a woman's testimony didn't count. So why would so many of the resurrection appearances include women? Because, hey, guess what? They did. But if you were trying to convince people, particularly Jewish people, you'd have a nice, clean row of good, upstanding men, preferably Pharisees, to convince the world. But it's not Jesus' way. And then basically Luke wants to make the point that the eyewitnesses themselves were totally convinced. Now, God forbid I ever have to give my life for my faith. I'm quite cowardly. I wouldn't fancy being in that position at all. But if I ever did, if I ever was in that situation, I would be giving my life for my faith. I have not seen the risen Christ. There is a difference with these people, these disciples. These disciples are, they are people of faith, but primarily they are eyewitnesses. So these are people that saw the risen Christ, and our faith stands on their encounters with Christ, not their faith, not their conviction about Jesus, the Son of God, not their conviction he was raised from the dead, or that he could forgive sins, but their eyewitness encounters with somebody that they saw crucified now come back from the dead. That's the point of these resurrection accounts. So our faith stands on what they actually experienced. And when they go on to talk about Jesus with such passion, they do so saying, we are eyewitnesses. We have to speak about what we've seen and heard with our own eyes. What else can we do? We can't keep this news to ourselves, because this person that was crucified, that the whole of Jerusalem saw crucified, we've seen raised from the dead. And this is precisely why Christianity began with such power in Jerusalem, the very place where Jesus was crucified. So if you think about it, if you're going to start a cult or some kind of offshoot religious new thing, you'd start it in Galilee, where Jesus' hometown was, where his friends were, where he grew up, right? You'd start it there, but you wouldn't start it in Jerusalem. Why? Because that's where he died. So basically, if there's ever going to be a place where it's not going to work, it's going to be the place where everybody saw him dead. So given that everybody saw him dead, and yet many people actually became Christians straight away, having witnessed his death, you've got to think, well, you know, there's something in this, isn't there? Something amazing must have happened. Why else would normal, rational people, and can we just put to one side the idea that people in those days didn't know a dead man when they saw one? I mean, seriously, you know, they might have been, you know, a couple of thousand years, you know, prior to us, but they probably knew death when they encountered it, don't you think? Are you really dead, darling? I'm just keeping you on a shelf for a while. Seriously, they would know death when they saw it, right? And death by crucifixion was just the most horrific thing, and nobody survived that, no one. So basically, it's astonishing that Christianity started right in the heart of conservative Judaism in Jerusalem, where all the evidence against the resurrection would have been, had there been any. Anyway, Luke presents these things to us so that we might have complete conviction about making the most of salvation history time now in the power of the Holy Spirit. So, once again, a special word for any who have not been doing a lot with what they've got. Right, now, the object of the game is this. We're supposed to do something out there in the world, and maybe that's the main place where we do something with what we've got. I mean, this is like a practice area, really. This is like the child safety zone, but the main action is supposed to happen out there. What you're supposed to do is come here like a knackered car running out of gas, and you're supposed to turn up here and plug yourself in and get refilled again so you can drive around again and then run out of gas and come back. So the experience of worship, teaching, getting prayed for, etc., relationship with other Christians is meant to fill you up so you can go out and drive around out there and knacker yourself, come back, and get refilled, and so on. That's the plan. That's the idea. Of course, all church fails to do that to one extent or another, but because it's made up of stupid people. But the fact is, that's its aim, and you should see it like that. So mainly, you want to be doing something out there, but also, it is not more spiritual to do something out there and do nothing in here. It's a dual thing. You're also supposed to do something in here too. Something. Just do something. I mean, some of the things that church needs to do, you know, are so simple, you don't need any kind of ability to do them at all. I mean, how much ability does it take to hand out those cookies when people come in, to serve tea when people come in, to give stuff to people from the information desk, to put out chairs? I mean, not much. Now, this is not a complaint from me, because the fact is people have always given their time and their energy in the church. I don't need you to help me out. The fact is, I'm just saying that in the church, it is good for us to be doing something. Now, some people carry that to an extreme, and they then collapse their life into the church. You don't want to do that. If you're going to pick one area to knacker yourself in, try doing it in the world. That would be better. But basically, you don't want to find yourself just in the safety zone of church. Some people do that. It's quite common for some people to become Christians and then sign up for everything. Literally everything. What course are you doing? I'm doing 10 courses. Are you? You're going to die. And they do die. And then basically, they, you know, the wheels come off, and then they blame me, usually. And I never told them to do that. But basically, it's a normal trajectory for some people, because they just do everything. I'm going to do everything. I'm going to find out everything and consume everything. That's what I would have done as a young Christian. I mean, it depends how obsessive you are. So if you're like me, you'll definitely do that. And so basically, you know, you do that for a bit, and then you work out. You know, you can't actually do everything. So In this church, there's always stuff kept rolling off the stage, things to do. You could do this, do you want to do this, do you fancy this? And I am trusting, and everybody else is trusting, that you will be working out what kind of shape is you, what kind of role is you. And if you need help with that, it's absolutely fine. Just ask for advice and help. But I would find something meaningful to do that fits your gifts, your passions, your excitements in the church, but mainly be involved out there. And you know what? If you are a parent of small children, and obviously a number of us are, could we please stop feeling guilty right now? Could you stop hitting yourself internally right now? If you are a parent with young children, the main thing you're going to be doing is looking after your children. It is a knackering, exhausting phase. Fortunately, it does end. It's a long, tired blur, as one person said to my wife and I when we started having them, a long, tired blur. It just is. And you are not going to have a lot of time and energy for anything in the church, or even, in some cases, much outside. You are surviving. It's fine. It's a massive life change. You know, you think when you get married, that's a big life change. It's nothing by comparison with having children. Absolutely nothing. And then by comparison with having two children, it's nothing. And by comparison with having three, flip me. These are all major life changes. Do you know how long it takes to come to terms with a life change? About 10 months of your life. About 10 months. After 10 months, you begin to have a framework for a new dimension of life. It's huge. We are so self-related, we are so egocentric, we are so turned in on ourselves that anything that involves us significantly dying to ourselves at all, like, for example, getting married, having a significant relationship, getting a new job, having a child, for goodness sake, any of those things, all of those things, we are so self-related, it's killing for us. It kills us. It sucks the energy out of us, and we think, I've got nothing left. Look at me, I'm going to die. I will die if I have to do anything else. It's the way it is. Doesn't last forever, does it? If you've been playing the game for a while, it doesn't last forever. It just goes on, you know, and then it changes into other things. Like we've got teenagers and it becomes more emotional, less physical. Don't have to dress them, brush their teeth, give them breakfast, but you do have to worry about whether they're going to come back at night, ever. So it just goes on. The challenge is always there. It just goes on. But I don't want you to feel bad because there simply aren't enough hours in your day to be down here. And I know that some of us commute in from a long way away. That's okay. You're welcome to be here on your own terms. Christianity is about nothing if it's not about grace. God's grace. You know, God likes you. He likes you. He likes you the way you are. He likes you when you're cocking it up. He still likes you. Nothing you can do will ever stop him from liking you. It's his, you know, modus operandi. It's the way he is. He just likes you. He likes you because he likes you, because he is love. So he continually loves you all the time, all the time. So if you've fallen off the bike, which happens to everyone, by the way, if you've fallen off the bike or you've started retreating into old habits, then you can just get back on now. So if you haven't really been doing very much, you can just volunteer again. It's really easy. You don't need to go through a long sort of process of, you know, getting yourself back into the right place. I think that bores God too. I just think it bores him. He just wants you to start doing something again. You know, I don't know whether this is just me, it probably is, but often when God has spoken to me, it's just been really simple and just the same thing, which is basically, could you just do that? It seems to be about that. So I will talk on and on and on, which I do tend to do, to God and to people. I'll talk on and on and on. But when I stop talking and I sense God really speaking to me, it's almost along the lines of, can we just start doing it again? That's it. It's not really complicated because I know what God has called me to do. It's been made very clear to me repeatedly. So I, when I get off track, I basically stop doing that. When I get back on track again, God just says, it's like, you know, that's all very interesting. Can we just start doing that again? And I think that's what tends to happen. I don't know whether that's true for you or not, but it seems to me that when you come back to a renewed sense of purpose within what God wants you to do. So I do hope this has been interesting to at least some people. I'm sure there's been something there for someone. Just think if it's just you, God's done that specially for you and held everybody else to complete boring captivity. Shows how much he loves you and has slight ambivalent feelings about everybody else. So in our church, we believe in, you know, worshipping God, hearing teaching, asking what God is saying to us, and getting prayed for at the end. Now, the getting prayed for at the end bit is about not just hearing an interesting thing or thinking, you know what, that was really true. And I can see that some of you feel a little bit, joking apart, I can see that some of you feel a bit convicted because of the way you're sort of nodding at me in a sort of grim or even happy way, some of you. So I know the signs because I've been playing the game for too long. And so basically, however, church isn't just hearing it and thinking, oh yeah, that was interesting. Oh, you know what, I was just thinking about that myself. Wonder what that means. Probably God. You know, we had somebody the other day, this really amused me, you shouldn't have done. Quite new to the church, and when we were doing this thing about money, they came up to me afterwards and said, you know, when there was that silence and you said, ask God to speak to you, well, this voice spoke to me and said, give £50. And you know what they said? They said, am I going mad? Is this going to happen again? What happens when I go home? Well, I keep hearing this voice. It's obviously quite new to the idea of God speaking. And we had a chat about that. I said, would it be a problem to give £50? Thinking maybe they haven't got £50. And she said, no, I've got £50 in my pocket. I've had it for a while in these jeans. I'm going to give £50. Shall I do it now? I said, okay. But you know, when God speaks, it's not complex. You tend to know when God's spoken to you, I think. If he's spoken to you, then you come forward and get prayed for. You don't have to, but basically, and also you don't have to say anything when you come forward. But you're saying, okay, God, I want your power for this to be different. Now, there are some people here and some people in the church who are very good at that. They always come forward. In fact, they come forward most weeks. Maybe they've got a different sort of problem, I don't know. But basically, there are other people who could really do with coming forward who don't very often come forward. And so, basically, you only do it when you think God's spoken to you. And what you're saying is, God, I'm responding to what you're saying. Please give me your power so that I can go and do it. Because your gifts, without the power of the Spirit, is a bit of a waste of time, actually. Because you're not just supposed to use your gifts. You're supposed to use your gifts in the power of the Spirit. Otherwise, it will all be about you once again. And it will soon fizzle out and become really boring. But you, in the power of the Spirit, connected with God, that'll be an amazing thing. Good. So, why don't we see what we think? Let's have a moment or two of silence and ask God what he has been saying to us, if anything, and, you know, commit it into his hands. Talk about it with God.